homework number three is on the left. It's just basically a list of problems you have to do from less and measure. So you go to a website, you go to a course website, and then there is some extra problems you have to solve. Okay, as I said, we had an agreement that the minimum you can get in this course is 80. And after that, there will be a distribution depending how much homework you did. So, so homework number three, unlike homework number one and homework number two, has a hard deadline, which is going to be our last day of the course, which is,
you can just see exactly when will be our last day of the course.
So the last lecture is going to be December 6th. Okay. So this is the date by which you have to return. Put it in my mailbox. So if you find it easier, or so anyway, by December 6th, I'm going to have all your homework assignments. So that week, the weekend, I'm going to mark it, and so you hopefully you'll get back to it. You'll get back it a week afterwards. Right, so this is homework due. Homework due. And so this is Thursday. Okay. So this is Thursday. Let's see. So that's number one. Number two, so there is an evaluation form that you guys have to fill in. Not from my university, with a UW, or I don't know why. Okay. So Mike doesn't care. in particular, I guess people from the Waterloo people, please fill in the evaluation form. So I'm gonna leave the forms here. Okay. So please take one. Okay. And I guess it's fairly important for them if they do that. So what you would need to write on the form is something I didn't know. It turns out that our course has a number, which is P physics 771. Okay. It also has an instructor, which is not Rob Myers. So please don't put Rob Myers. We set it out. It's easier, but you know, Rob should not be lying. So instructor, instructor, okay, okay, and so I'm at UW/PI. A final, highly non-trivial thing, I didn't know that we also have a section. So our section is 0.5. Okay, so those are the details you would need to fill in on those evaluation forms. So may I please ask you, once you get those forms, you return it to Leanne, okay? If you don't, I don't think there will be any name of yours there anyway. But first of all, I promise I will not give it to you all. actually, it's the other way around. So, you can give these to, well, I don't think Rob wants to have them anyway. So, is that okay? You guys return it to Leah? Is that fine?
Where do we get the forms?
The forms, okay, can I have arms for people who are going to fill the forms? Okay, 2, 3. Good. Anybody else?
Do we need to be registered?
Sorry?
Do we need to be registered to fill it out?
Do we, yeah, you will get paid if you don't fill it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not registered for the
call. Okay. So anybody else here? Nobody. Okay, so please, so you guys know where Leanne's office is?
Do you?
Okay, so please give the phone back to Leanne. All right, good. So we're done. We're done with this admin stuff. Now, how many of you have been at the seminar earlier today? See, Shamit beat me. It's exactly the model that I wanted to discuss today. It's super QED, but anyway. All right. Let's continue. So what we're going to do, so I want to finish this week the supersymmetric gauge series. And then next week, we will do non-perturbative effects. And the last week, which will be a week after that, we will do a solution of Cyber-Quinton model. We might start doing Cyber-Quinton model earlier next week if we will be done. All right, so let's go ahead. So let's recall what we discussed last time. So last time we started SUSY vector series, SUSY vector multiplet. And in fact, we started a U1 multiplet. And so what we noticed that we can introduce a field strength, which is a super field given by this expression, okay? And so what we noticed is that W alpha is a chiral super field, okay? And moreover, it's invariant on the general, transformations, SUSY gauge transformations. And so basically what those transformations were, remember those are the transformations where V was changing to lambda plus lambda bar, where lambda was a chiral superfield, right? So where V bar alpha of lambda was equal to zero. Okay, so we did all the computation in the Vezzumino gauge, all right? And so what we, where we ended last time, right. So first of all, we showed that this is a chiral superfield. So what we did, we constructed a supersymmetric Lagrangian, right? So we constructed a SUSY Lagrangian. So the way we did this, since it's a chiral superfield, it carries a spinor index. So first of all, we constructed a combination, which is a Lorentz scalar by contracting spinor index. And then we multiply this by minus I tau, okay, divided by 16 pi. So where tau is a complexified coupling, right? So tau was equal to 4 pi over e squared times I plus theta over 2 pi. So e is a gauge coupling, right? So e is a coupling constant. Is a U1 coupling, right? And so the Lagrangian is just an integral over half of the superspace, right? And plus its Hermitian conjugate, okay? So in this way, we will get a supersymmetric U1 gauge theory, okay? And so if we evaluate this explicitly, right? So we evaluated this Lagrangian explicitly, and what we found that it took the following form. So first of all, there is a standard U1 Lagrangian, right, coming from a vector potential, which is part of the vector superfield.
And then there is an kinetic term for the uncharged for Gino, right, which was the super partner of our photon. Right? So it's given by this. And then remember that in the Vezzumino gauge, our vector superfield had an auxiliary field D, which was neutral. So there is a contribution here, D squared. And then there was one more interesting term. Okay, except that I forgot couplings. So 4 e squared, then over 2 e squared, then this guy, 1 over e squared, and then there is the nice theta term, theta over 32 pi squared, f mu nu, f wilde mu nu, okay? And so this f wilde mu nu was a Hodge dual. So this was 1/2 epsilon mu nu lambda rho, f lambda rho. So this is a supersymmetric Lagrangian, which came after we integrate over half of the superspace. And then there is an additional contribution, which is known as Pyatt-Linopoulos term, right? So this contribution comes, this is an additional gauge invariant term, which comes once I integrate over full superspace, right? So that automatically produces, again, a Susi invariant Lagrangian of the vector superfield. And I do it with some coupling. So in earlier today, this K here, constant here, is what Shamit called R. Okay? So if we do this, this is K times D. But that Pyatt-Linopoulos constant. All right, so that was as far as concerned supersymmetric U1 gauge theory. And so what we observed that there are no quantum corrections here. So the theory that we discussed is exact quantum mechanically. And the reason is non-renormalization theorem. Exact quantum mechanically. And then we understood that the statement is trivial because there are no fields charged under this U1. And so our U1 field theory is actually free. So that's why there are no interesting quantum effects. So in order to get something interesting, we're going to introduce matter. We have to introduce fields which are charged under U1. So you can think of them as a supersymmetric generalization of electron. And so the next step that we're going to discuss, is supersymmetric QED. Okay? So pretty much what we would like to do, we would like to gauge a Vezzumino model. So we would consider, consider Vezzumino model with charged chiral superfield, okay? And so the Lagrangian that will arise will have two parts, as usual in Vezzumino model. There will be a kinetic term. There will be Lagrangian coming from a Keller potential. So this comes from Keller potential. And then there will be terms which include interactions, and those would come from a superpotential. I'll denote them as potential energy, right? Potential contribution. So what we want to do, we want to start with some simple Vezzumino model, and we want to gauge a global symmetry, very much like the discussion goes when we take a theory of scalar fields with a global symmetry and we gauge it. So what we're going to do, we're going to gauge global symmetry in Vasimino model. Okay, and then we will see that in order for us to achieve that, we actually need a vector superfield, right? So remember, Vasimino model, it's a renormalizable quantum field theory, which includes chiral and anti-chiral superfields only. Okay, so very good. So what we're going to do, we're going to consider that our chiral superfields, okay, they carry some charges, right, they're charged under global symmetry. And so a chiral superfield phi I has a global charge. For now, it's a global charge, and then we turn it into a local symmetry by gauging it. Has a global charge, charge QI. So what this means, that if I do has a global U1 charge Q sub I. So if I do the symmetry transformations corresponding to this U1, so my phi I will change into phi I e to the minus I lambda Q sub I. So a lambda is a U1 angle, right? So it's, well, an angle of a phase, and as I said, QI is a charge, right? So so when we talk about Vasimino model, so Vasimino model has a superpotential. It includes only renormalizable parts in the superpotential. So in particular, it includes a mass term, right? Mij phi I phi j. I'm not writing down a linear term because in many circumstances, that linear term can be shifted away. So there can be a mass term, and another is a cubic interaction lambda I j k, and then I have phi I phi j, and then I have phi k. So before we're going to gauge a symmetry, right, so we want to be sure that it is a symmetry. And so you can see that in order that you want with the charge, as I said, be a global symmetry, so for U1 to be a global symmetry, so what we need to do, we need to require that superpotential is invariant. So a U1 charge of W must be equal to zero. So in particular, this requires that Mij, the mass term, should vanish if Qi plus Qj is not equal to zero. So if Qi plus Qj is not equal to zero, then this bilinear will get shifted by this global U1 symmetry. And so we have to require that those terms are absent. And so similarly, lambda ijk must be equal to zero if Qi plus Qj plus Qk is not equal to zero.
Yes, that's a more precise thing. That's correct.
Can you do the same trick you did for the proving the non-renormalization thing and then say that Mij has some charge as well?
Right. So in principle, yes, but then that means that I will be changing my theory. Right. So what you want me to do now, you really want me to say that Mij is a field which is charged under U1. And if you're going to tell me that that field develops a valve, which is the only way how I can interpret this being a mass, and if it is charged under U1, so my
gauge symmetry is broken, okay? Which means that I do not have a massless photon, for example. Right, so this is possible, but it's not good enough here. So at low energies, I don't have a vector multiply. I really want to have a massless vector multiply, which would be required in order for me to gauge the global symmetry.
I was just confused, just that it's also okay if QI is sum up to 2.5 or 11.
Well, if it is a multiple of 2 pi,
yeah,
right?
It's supposed to be better for any function.
Right. So yeah, so it's not.
It needs to sum up to zero.
It really needs to sum up to zero.
Why?
Well, because lambda is an arbitrary phase, right? So I'm not doing rotations by multiples of 2 pi, right? So I need this guy to be a really continuous symmetry. Yeah, thanks, Matt. So any questions, comments? All right, good. All right, guys. So once we realize that this is the case, right? So if we have a global U1 symmetry, then we can gauge it. And the way we're going to gauge it is we're going to say that now our constant phase, lambda was a constant phase, it depends on coordinate, right? So it becomes a function of x, and normally this would lead to electrodynamics, right? But what we want to do now, we want to do one more step, and we want to promote this bosonic component to a full chiral superfield. So it will be a lowest component of a chiral superfield lambda. Okay? So this lambda is a chiral superfield. Okay? And so in other words, so what I want to do, I want to insist that my gauge transformations are defined by chiral superfields, which is a natural thing. Remember that when we talked about a vector superfield, the gauge transformations were defined by chiral superfield. More precisely, the gauge transformations were defined by this combination of a chiral superfield, arbitrary chiral superfield. So those were gauge transformations for a vector superfield. And so it seems natural to try to attempt this procedure in gauging the global symmetry. So our lambda is a chiral superfield. And so now we have to modify the transformation rule. So now we're going to say that our chiral superfield phi I, right? So gets transformed into e to the minus I qi lambda phi I, okay? And so of course, this maps chiral superfields into chiral superfields. Lambda is a chiral superfield. But also, what we will require is that an anti-chiral superfield conjugate to that will transform with lambda bar. Okay. So if we postulate these transformation rules, then what will happen is that W of phi I is invariant. Okay, so again, we are talking about a Bessonian model, a model which was invariant under the global transformations. And so, what we did, we simply are thinking now about the phase as a chiral superfield. And in the superpotentials, there are no derivatives. So, the fact that this chiral superfield is a field doesn't really matter. So this guy is invariant. So the interesting thing will happen with caliper tensor. So we have to look at kinetic term. We have to look at the caliper tensor. And so the classical caliper tensor is of this type. So I have phi I bar phi I. And so if I do, if I now do my gauge transformations, right? So what will happen is that phi I bar phi I will get shifted into e to the I q sub I, and then I have lambda bar minus lambda, which no longer will be gauge invariant. So however, there is a simple rule how we can restore a U1 invariant of the Keller potential. And in order to do that, all we have to do is to add we have to add a vector superfield. Okay, so if I'm gonna add a vector superfield V, and I'm gonna define so this vector superfield will have a gauge transformations V goes to V plus I lambda minus lambda bar, right? So I changed slightly the transformation rule. This was a chiral superfield. So before, earlier today, I was saying that V was going to V plus phi bar. So if you wish, my phi equals I lambda. Okay, so then that doesn't change anything. Okay, so once we realize that, then I can make Keller potential for chiral superfields to be an invariant by modifying it. So I start with phi I bar phi I. And so I'm going to modify it into phi I bar e to the q I v, right? And then I have phi I. So if I now do gauge transformations, good. Well, just pieces of the chalk. Okay. So it's clear that now this guy, phi I bar, which is a QIV, phi I bar, will go into itself, right? So I'm not gonna write down this. However, what I also need to do, once I introduce the vector superfield, I also need to introduce, I also wanna make this vector superfield dynamical, and so I need to introduce kinetic term. So what we need a kinetic term, for our vector superfield. And so that brings to a complete Lagrangian for super QED. Okay. So there is a Keller potential, right, for the chiral superfield. So I have sum over all of my chiral superfields. So that will be an integral over whole superspace. So I have a gauge invariant Keller potential, phi I bar. And then there is a superpotential, right? So plus an integral over half of a superspace. Okay, so now my superpotential will include a U1 invariant superpotential for the chiral superfield. And then we must include, as I just mentioned, a kinetic term a kinetic term for a U1. So this is W alpha, and then plus emission conjugate. All right, guys, so any questions? Yes.
Say it again, why?
Why are there no cross terms like the finite energy and the
You can have it,
okay.
But if you wish, I diagonalize it.
Okay.
So in principle, right, so when we talk about, for example, a nonlinear sigma module, in which I will mention the generalization later,
that it can be an arbitrary function. So then, in this case, if you wish, if I have a Keller potential II, then there will be a flat metric on a configuration space of my chiral superfield, chiral anti-chiral superfield. So otherwise, the metric will have an all diagonal terms because there will be del, right? Remember, the metric is the del 2k over del phi I del phi j bar, right? There will be an off diagonal terms in that case. But if I have a classical Keller potential, I can always do a rotation field redefinitions. All right, so, right. So what type of things we can observe about this theory? Well, first of all, if W of phi I is at most cubic, in our superfields, right, which is pretty much a definition of the gauged by Zunino model, right? So then our theory is renormalizable. By power counting. Okay, so because it is renormalizable as by power counting, it exists as a well-defined quantum field theory. There is actually slight subtlety compared to this last statement. So the last statement is, and thus exists as a consistent, I shouldn't say consistent, thus exists as quantum field theory at arbitrary high energy. Right? So, but there is a small subtlety here, and this is a subtlety that we're gonna discuss next week, and this is related to anomalies, okay? It turns out that this theory is a consistent field theory provided there are constraints on the charges of chiral superfields. Okay, and so those constraints in this particular model are related to gravitational anomalies. So those are the anomalies that will come about if we try to couple a theory like that to gravity. And so cancellation of these anomalies actually will require that the sum of all charges, so I have a set of chiral superfields carrying some charges q sub I, so the cancellation of anomalies provided anomalies canceled. And we'll discuss about anomalies next week when we talk about quantum aspects of gauge theories. So one of the requirements is a cancellation. The sum of all charges must vanish. And then also the sum of the cubes of all charges must vanish as well. So those are the conditions that are placed on our theory by anomalies. All right, so as I said, we'll see at least some aspects of anomalies. We will discuss next week. or maybe even this week, if we can move fast enough. All right, so what I would like to do now is, so what we managed to do, we started with a Vezzumino model with the global symmetry, and then we gauged that global symmetry, right? So we know that in Vezzumino model, so before gauging, so what we had a potential for our scalar for scalars in chiral multiplets, and so the potential for the scalars was simply a sum of F terms, right? So this is a scalar potential, right? Scalar potential, where the F terms are given by the derivatives of the superpotential, that's del W over del phi I, absolute value squared. So what we would like to do now, we would like to ask the question, what will happen with the potential for our scalars, right? Once we couple the Vezzumino model to a supersymmetric U1 multiplet. So in particular here, we needed F sub I equal to zero to have supersymmetry, right? Because the supersymmetry requires that the energy of the ground state is zero, so the potential energy must vanish. So what we would see now, exactly the modification due to coupling to vector multiplet. Okay. Right. So what I'm going to do now, I'm just going to write down the answer. So we wrote up here the Lagrangian for super QED, right? And what I can do, I can just evaluate these Grassmann integrals and give you the answer what they are. What this Lagrangian look like in terms of components. So we will have, there will be an F term. So I just limit to a single chiral superfield, right? So there will be an F term. So the interesting thing that will change is that before we just had a kinetic term for the scalars, right? So we had del mu phi bar squared. So now there is a modification to the kinetic term for the scalars that come from this vector multiplet, and so if we do the expansion as we discussed before and evaluate this Grassmann integral, what we will find out is that the kinetic term for the scalars get changed into the normal derivative will change into a gauge covariant derivative. So we'll have minus IQ, and then I have a coupling to a mu phi, okay, absolute value squared. And then the same thing happens with fermions, right? So my chiral superfield has phi. Psi is a superpartner of a complex scalar phi. So I have minus I psi bar sigma bar mu, and then I have del mu minus pi over 2 q a mu. Sorry. So again, before we gauge the Vesemino model, those terms are absent. Okay. And then there is a Yukawa coupling q between fermions in vector multiplet and a chiral multiplet. So I have a scalar phi lambda bar psi bar minus phi bar lambda psi. And then there is 1/2 qd phi bar phi. And then finally, there is a Fayette-Linopoulos term, the one that I reminded you earlier today. Right? So let me ask you, do I need to derive this, or you will be comfortable doing it? Do I need to show this? So in principle, again, it's a simple exercise. We did similar exercises before. We take a chiral superfield, we expand it into components, right? So we do the computation in a Vesemino gauge. In a Vesemino gauge, so what happens is that e to the qiv is 1 plus qiv plus 1/2 qi squared v squared, and that's it, right? And so we just evaluate that product phi e to the qv phi bar and collect a theta squared, theta bar squared component of that. So if you do that, you will get some parts coming from the kinetic term, and then there will be a contribution coming from a superpotential. All right. So this guy, this is what will come from the Keller potential, and as I said, there will also be a contributions coming from a superpotential. So, the contributions from a superpotential will have this form. There is 1/2 2 e squared d squared plus plus f bar del w phi over del phi bar plus phi l w del phi. Okay, plus there will be other terms. Okay. So those are the terms I wrote. Those are the terms that will be important for scalar potential. So part of the Lagrangian that will be relevant for the scalar potential. So let me collect all these parts. It will be these terms, right? I w del phi bar del w del phi. Plus potential terms that involve scalars coming from Keller potential, q phi bar phi, and then I have plus ff bar. All right, so very good. So first of all, coupling a chiral multiplet to a vector multiplet did not change the fact that that F and D are auxiliary superfields. Auxiliary fields, right? And so we can integrate them out classically, and the procedure is exact. Right, they enter only quadratically. what we need to do, we need to solve for F, FR, and D, and substitute it back in order to obtain the potential for scalars. So the equation of motion for the F, right? So I need to vary. I need to vary with respect. I just need to vary with respect for the F bar with respect to F. And so we will have the D guy minus del W over del phi. And then I have F equals minus del W bar over del phi bar. So those are the equations of motion for F component. And then we have the equation of motion for D, right? So there will be a contribution there. So I have, so D over E squared, and then there is a piece there, plus 1/2. Okay, so one thing that I forgot, there is plus KD. So plus 1/2 Q phi bar phi, and then there is a K here. Okay, so it must also vanish. So the equation of motion for D is equal to minus E squared. So I have K plus 1/2 Q phi bar phi. So we have the solution for F of bar and D, and so I can plug this into the expression for the part of the Lagrangian involving scalars. And so if we do that, that part of the Lagrangian will become minus del W over del phi absolute value squared, and there is minus E squared over 8, and I have 2K plus Q phi bar phi squared. Okay, and so I told you that this is all in the Lagrangian that will contain scalar terms, and so we have our potential for the scalars will be equal to del phi del W over del phi absolute value squared plus E squared over 8 2K plus Q phi bar squared. Okay? So the combination here is something that we have seen before. This is just FF bar, and the combination there is 1 over 2E squared D squared. So what we see here, and this is a general feature, is that a potential energy for a scalar is first of all, it's always positive, which is required by supersymmetry algebra, right? And so what we see that it's a sum of there is an F term contribution. So there is an F term contribution. And then there is also a D term contribution. And so those terms come as squares. And so in order for us to have a supersymmetry preserving vacuum, what must be the case is that both the F terms and D terms vanish. So in a SUSY vacuum, F must be equal to 0, and D must be equal to 0 as well. So we will discuss in a little bit one model, which actually is exactly the almost exactly the same as what Shamit talked earlier today. Okay, so everything, before I go on, are there any questions? No? So let's, before looking at some example, let's generalize it. So everything that we said is possible to generalize to nonlinear, gauge nonlinear sigma model. And so what we're going to do, we're going to assume that we have a bunch of chiral superfields, phi sub I, and those chiral superfields has lots of global symmetries. Okay, so the model has lots of global symmetries, and so they have charges QA, QA sub I, right? So where A is a U1 index, so this is a U1 index, right? So there are a bunch of U1 global symmetries, and our chiral superfields have different charges in principle. So what we can do, we can generalize the models that I just discussed when we have an arbitrary number of U1s. And so as the first intermediate step in this generalization, we can still have a classical Keller potential, right? So what we will have is Q sub I, and then I have e to the QIA. So for each of the U1, I would need to introduce a vector superfield, okay, in order to properly gauge in a supersymmetric context a global U1 symmetry, okay? And then in principle, I can have as many phi etalinophilous terms as they have U1s, because all these terms will be invariant under supersymmetry transformation as well. So the interesting thing is that now I'm going to write down the most general superpotential. So the most general superpotential, I can break into two parts. The first part just involves the superpotential of the chiral superfield by sub I. But then for each of the vector superfield, we need to introduce a kinetic term. And so each of these, so for each of VA, we need to introduce double field strengths, corresponding field strengths. So the novelty compared to the models that we discussed before is that I can consider a most general, if you wish, a more general kinetic term for U1 gauge superfield. So there will be W alpha to the space time spin index I'm contracting, but I'm not contracting, if you wish, the U1 indices, right? So I have WA, WB. So, and now I have a coupling, right? So I'm going to write it down in the same way how we had before, except that now it will carry two indices, A and B, and so I will have to sum over all those indices over 16 pi, right? And so this is, in principle, in the example that we discussed before, tau AB was just tau times delta AB, chronicle symbol. It was a constant. So now what I can assume, I can actually assume that this is an arbitrary function. So all what is required from me is that the whole combination here is a chiral superfield, because in that case, integrating over half of the superspace will give me a supersymmetric Lagrangian. So the generalization that can be made is we're going to assume that our couplings, U1 couplings, will now depend on chiral superfields phi sub I. Yes.
And they're all the separate U1s.
Which one? So this one, is this one clearly
lower one, the one with the T?
This one, tau. Right. So first of all, this depends on the scalars, and it needs to make it dependent on the scalars in such a way that it was in Meran before under global U1 symmetries, right? So it's very similar discussion to what we had here for the superpotential. If I write it down in terms of series, Mij, phi I, phi j, then Mij must be equal to zero if the sum of the charges for the superfields doesn't add up to zero. So for example, the way you can think of is what could happen is that suppose I just have a single, let me give you an example where I just have one index A, right? So A and B are the same, but there is some non-trivial dependence. So you can assume that I have two chiral superfields. One carries charge plus one, the other one carries a charge minus one. So what I can say is that, for example, in the example there, once I have two chiral superfields, I can say that my coupling, just an arbitrary function of the product phi minus phi plus. Right? This is a field strength, right? So the field strength is invariant under, right? It's already invariant, yes. So as long as, I guess what, I didn't quite understand your question. So as long as before we had, before we gauge our theory, we didn't have this term at all. So we actually need to specify this, that this tau AB, if you wish, is a chiral superfield. Again, much like a superpotential, except that, we require it to be invariant under all global symmetries. And that will not change after we gauge those global things. All right, so any questions?
No. All right, guys, so let's see where we are.
Okay, good. So that was just an intermediate step when what I did. Oh, by the way. So you can ask, if I do an expansion, what would happen with this term, right? How should I think of this? And this is in some sense related to your question before. If I have, for example, just in ordinary, I'm just going to give you some intuition what this term corresponds to. So in ordinary quantum field theory, right, if I have a bunch of scalar superfields, so I can have a kinetic term, del mu phi I, del mu phi j, right, and aij, if you wish, is some non-degenerate matrix, right? So I have a non-canonical kinetic term. I can always do a field redefinition, right, so that which diagonalizes this matrix. Right, so this is a non-canonical. Kinetic term for scalars. But then by the same token, I can introduce a non-canonical kinetic term for vectors. So what I'm saying is that for the photon, we have f mu term, right? So with say one over e squared, so we have this kinetic term. Now what I can have if I have a bunch of u1s, so I will have an index I here, right? And then the constant, the coupling constant before, I can interpret as so if you wish tau ii over 4 e squared f mu nu I, f mu nu I, right? But then, much like in the case of scalars, I can introduce a non-canonical kinetic term, or if you wish, do a field redefinition, which involves to taking a linear combination of my scalars. By the same way, I can do, I can take an arbitrary linear combination on my vectors. And so what this would mean, if I do a general transformation, then my coupling will change, right? So, okay, so this was not, I guess I should have written it. Imaginary part of tau ii, right? So now this will be an imaginary part of tau ij, right? And then I have f mu I, well, tilde in principle, f mu j. So the term that you see here is just a generalization of the stuff that you could have done just for ordinary U1 field series, right? Okay. All right, guys. So, so the last step is to completely generalize it, right? To a nonlinear sigma model by taking a more general Keller potential, right? So now we start with completely general nonlinear sigma model, and we're gonna gauge it. So we start with a Keller potential, right? So in our case now, the Keller potential is an arbitrary function of anti-chiral superfields and chiral superfields. And so we're gonna assume, again, in order for us to gauge a symmetry, it must be a global symmetry. So in particular, we're gonna look at the class of Keller potentials, which are invariant under the symmetry transformation. So if we do the rotation, right? So let me just for now talk about an arbitrary, writing down indices is trivial. So let's look at the single phi. Yes.
What do you mean there is? Everything is invariant, right?
So then the charge is conserved if I have gauge invariant.
Are they independent?
Yeah. Right. So, see, by definition, this I is the only thing I have to say is that this tau AD is invariant under gauge transformation, right?
Okay.
All the rest is invariant under. That's a field strength.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So remember that before what we did, we learned how to gauge a symmetry when the Keller potential was phi bar phi. And I want to tell you how you're going to gauge it, if a Keller potential is an arbitrary function. So it's always possible to do. Again, it makes sense to talk about gauging a symmetry if it was a global symmetry. So global symmetry meant that there was an invariance. There was an invariance of our Keller potential if we do the symmetry transformation, right? And so in particular, our Keller potential was invariant under e to the So if I have whatever function I had before, it will be the same function, will be the same function afterward. Bar. And then this guy, which is a minus lambda cube phi. Okay? So if this is a case, then I can always gauge, so this is a global symmetry. Of course, it doesn't allow arbitrary Keller potentials. It restricts a class, much like we got a restriction on the possible superpotentials. But as long as my Keller potential is invariant under this global symmetry, then I claim that I can make it invariant under local symmetry. Yeah. Sorry? No, I will write down the general numbers. But I just want to give you the simplest simplest expression. So if that is the case, then the claim is that k of phi bar, and then I have e to the q v phi is invariant under local supersymmetric gauge transformation. Provided that our v will go to v plus I lambda bar minus lambda, right? And then phi will go to phi e to the minus I lambda q, and phi bar will go to phi bar e to the plus I lambda bar. Lambda bar q. Okay, now the statement is really trivial because, again, well, you can substitute and you can see that that's indeed the case. So the transformation of V will precisely guarantee that what you end up having is a generalization of this type, right? So the only non-conservation once we go from ordinary gauge transformations to SUSY gauge transformations is that my anti-chiral superfields are shifted by, are rotated by anti-chiral gauge parameter, okay? Are rotated by lambda bar instead of lambda, but that's being taken care of by appropriate transformation of a vector superfield. And so I will end up having a combination much like there, which guarantees me that what I have here will be precisely what I have before. Of course, there is a subtlety here. So by saying this, I am assuming that there are no derivatives. Well, this is a scalar function. There are no derivatives here. Because if there are derivatives, then I have to worry. All right, so any questions? So again, so now we have the most general. So I guess just answering Sean's question. So I can write down more generally. So if I have a Keller potential that involves phi sub I, and if I have lots of U1s, then all I have to do is to take this Keller potential and modify e to the q IA, V sub A, this is phi, this was phi bar, and this is phi I, okay? So if I do that, and if before the gauging my Keller potential was invariant under a bunch of global U1s, then that guy is guaranteed to be invariant under local U1s. So in general, once we talk about nonlinear sigma model, the theory is no longer renormalizable. And so I have to think of this only as a low energy effective field theory. However, what I said about anomalies, one beautiful property of the anomalies is that anomalies in the theory is quantum inconsistencies of this of your theories, but those are quantum inconsistencies at low energies. Okay, so something that we'll discuss in more details next week are that anomalies. low energy inconsistencies. So that's in particular one of the, well, so there are lots of facts about anomalies. Well, again, we talk next week about that. But the important thing is that not only the issues whether the theory is anomalous or not is applicable to renormalizable theories, it's also a crucial constraint on effective field theory. Even though I have a field theory which is valid only at some low energies, my theory better be anomaly free. Okay, otherwise it's inconsistent. So for this reason, the most general nonlinear sigma model coupled to the bunch of U1 will also have a constraint coming from anomaly cancellation. And so this constraint is of the type. So for each A, right, for each A, the sum of charges must vanish. Okay, so this is just a statement. We'll talk next week about this. And then there is a requirement for cancellation of cubic charges. So this is for arbitrary A, B, and C. So for each A, B, and C, notice that I'm summing over over all chiral multiplets. But this equation, this anomaly cancellation conditions must be valid for arbitrary choice of U1 gauge groups. Okay, guys, so the next topic, the next topic is non-abelian supersymmetric gauge theories. But before I go to that, I'm just going to discuss, something related still to a bunch of U1s. And in particular, the reason for that is today's lecture by Shamit, right? So, so we'll look at exactly the model that he talked about, and I'm just going to make some comments about it as well. So again, I'm not going to derive those things, most of them, what I'm going to say. So comment on Susi breaking. Okay. So remember that in order, if we look at the simplest Vezzemino model, in order for us to have a supersymmetry preserving vacuum, what is a necessary condition is that when evaluated at vacuum, the scalar potential must vanish. That's why we cared so much about computing the scalar potential. And so the scalar potential was the sum of the F term and a D term. And so the condition for the existence of a Susi preserving vacuum is that our F term vanish and also a D term for, so if I have a bunch of chiral superfields, F sub I for each of them must vanish. D terms for each of the U1 must vanish as well. So in the example, in particular the example that So the statement that I want to make is the following. So it is possible to prove the following theorem. So if you wish, the theorem if we can solve F-term condition, then we can always solve, then we can then we can always always solve for a D-term condition. D-term. As well, and that statement had one subtlety, provided Fayette-Linopoulos terms vanish, right? So this was true provided our K, if we have a bunch of gauge groups, so provided K sub A vanish. So what I want to do, I want to briefly mention the model. And we can see how we can parameterize the moduli space in that model and actually see. So before, when we started with the Zunino models, we saw that there could be moduli terms coming from solving an F-term condition. So actually, there are also an examples where we have moduli terms coming from solving D-term conditions. And I also mentioned how this phenomena, that it's important that we don't have any Fayette-Linopoulos terms, otherwise we can have a supersymmetry breaking, so which is something that was discussed today. Okay, so my primary reason for this for the model I'm going to talk is that this is an example of a moduli space. Moduli space from D terms, right? So we'll look at some simple U1 model, and we will see that there is a space of moduli coming from solving D terms condition. Okay, so we'll have a U1. So the model is a U1 gauge theory. It's a U1 SUSY gauge theory. And we're gonna have two chiral multiplets, which will carry charges +1 and -1. And so I'm gonna have a simple Keller potential. So it will be phi plus, right? E to the plus V phi plus buff. And then I have plus phi minus. And then I have e to the minus v, right? So here we have q times v, but our charge q plus equals +1, q minus equals to -1, and then I have q minus, so I don't. So in principle, there could be a Fayette-Linopoulos term, but but in order for me to actually have a moduli space, I will not have it. So no Fayette-Linopoulos term. Okay, so. So we also want a simple model in which we can solve the F-term equation. And so the simplest way in which we can solve F-term equations trivially, well, first of all, the superpotential must be an arbitrary function of phi plus, phi minus. That will make it gauge invariant. And well, if we make a superpotential 0, then we solve the F-term equations. So F-term trivially solved, right? Because there will be del double, the solution to the F-term equation is del W over del phi plus or del phi minus equal to 0, and that's clearly the condition, del W over del phi plus del W over delta phi minus equal to 0. So if you go back and look at today's lecture, so the model that Shamit discussed had a Fayette Lyapunov term and also had a potential, a superpotential, and the superpotential was a product of phi plus and phi minus, and he actually demonstrated that there is a supersymmetry breaking in this model, which doesn't contradict the statement I made here, because you can see that that supersymmetry breaking occurs only because you have a Fayette-Lyapunov term. If you set the Fayette-Lyapunov term to zero, then you will have a supersymmetry preserving vacuum, and in order to get those vacua, you will solve the F terms. Okay, and you can see that the D terms can always be solved in those cases. So let's continue discussing this model, right? So according to the general statement, the F terms are solved, so I should be able to have supersymmetry preserving vacua, and they will come only from the solution of D terms. So let's see what we will have here. Okay, so before we had an expression for the D terms in case, well, so let me write down what we had before. So this is an expression that we had before, right? So this condition was when we had a single U1 and we had a single chiral superfield, right? And a Q was the charge of this chiral superfield. So if we have a bunch, for phi sub I, so I still have a single U1, but I have a set of chiral superfield phi sub I, which charges Q sub I, okay? So so in this case, the D term takes this form. So I have K plus 1/2 Q sub I. So here I have phi sub I. Okay, so this is a generalization that will come about if I have a set of chiral superfields phi sub I. And so in our particular case, so for the model that we discussed there, so the D term takes this form. So it's gonna be E squared, right, divided by 2. So I have Fayette-Lyapunov term vanishing, right? So I have 1/2 E squared, and then I have phi plus squared absolute value minus phi minus squared absolute value. Okay, so in order for us, remember, in order for us to have a supersymmetry vacuum, not only must the F term vanish, but also the D term must vanish as well. So D must vanish. And so what must be the case is that absolute value of phi plus squared must be equal to absolute value phi minus squared. So this statement tells us that that those two expectation values must be the same up to a phase. So I can say that phi plus equals to phi minus, right, times e to the I alpha, where alpha is some phase. Now, in order to characterize an inequivalent vacuum of the theory, we want to make sure that no two vacua are related to each other by gauge transformations. And in fact, it is precisely the gauge transformation that would allow us to set this phase to zero, right? So so if I do gauge transformation, right, so we search for gauge inequivalent, vacua. And so I want to see how the solution to the D-term equations, I want to find solutions to the D-term equations, which are invariant under gauge transformations. And so in particular, what will happen if I do a gauge transformation, so phi plus gets shifted to minus I lambda E, right? And so the condition is that E, so this guy will get shifted to this. And so it is clear that by choosing appropriate U1 phase, right? So if I set lambda equal minus two alpha divided by E, so I can always, remove alpha. So what this tells us that the gauge invariant vacuum manifold right, so before, if I look at this condition, I would naively say that the gauge invariant vacua is arbitrary value. It's actually two real dimensions, right? Because I can take an arbitrary value of phi plus, right, the absolute value, and plus I have an arbitrary phase. So what I am telling you that we will be misleading ourselves if we say that there is a two real dimensional parameter space of vacua, because this arbitrary, what appear to be an arbitrary phase, I can remove by doing gauge transformation. So vacuum manifold, manifold is just a set of, if you wish, absolute value of phi plus. Well, actually I don't wanna, so what I said is correct. So for now, let me just put it phi plus. And so in fact, I can assume that for the vacuum manifold, phi plus equal to phi minus. So there is a seminar right now. So there is a subtlety in there, and there is a set on Z2 identification that we will discuss tomorrow. All right, guys? So see, not tomorrow, Thursday.